session number 11206, reel 12.
Mr. T. Thornthwaite, reel 12. You were talking, Mr. Thornthwaite, about the actions and fighting round Tobruk being very much like First World War conditions. Did you have stand to, for example?
Yes, we used to have stand to at dawn in the morning. Everybody, just before it got light, took up positions in the gun posts, gun positions, and of course it was the same all the way along the perimeters of Tobruk. And then again at night time, at dusk, we done exactly the same sort of thing, because seemingly they were the ideal time for Gerry to attack at dawn or dusk. Yeah. So we did the stand too. Part of the other duties was these listening posts that I think I mentioned. They used to have them out during the day and at night time. They're always in front of the wire, in front of our main wire. And the idea was to give the main wire a sort of warning if there was any attack imminent at night or daytime. And one there we used to do on the side of the anti-tank trench. There was four or five of us used to go out, and we had an old alarm clock to keep the time so you'd done your two on and four off, and while the others slept, you kept the watch, and then you woke your next friend up. And I remember, if I was feeling wide awake, I used to put the clock back another 2 hours and carry on. And then next person got up, and he would say, well, that was a long sleep, and then they take over, and he does, and then they come to my second turn, and I used to do about 5 minutes, and then put the clock back again, and then wake me relief up, who'd already had 2 hours. He says, it didn't seem long, and he come on. And that was one of the other duties we used to do as far as in the positions. Daytime, it was very quiet, as I think I mentioned before. There's very little activity. Everybody sort of rested, and well, you couldn't do much other than the actual, if you're going to do an attack during the day, which you didn't do. So you reserved all your energy for night time when everybody become active. We did lots of patrols over the German wire, but the Germans never did patrols into our wire for some reason. I don't think they bothered during the 1914 war, from what I gather reading. They never bothered with raids into our wire.
The positions were heavily mined. Were you involved in lifting mines and laying mines?
We didn't. We had engineers. The engineers used to go out as a escort for them or guard for them, while they went and moved mines and put mines out, or go out and lift Italian box mines, which was about 2'6" long, like a coffin. And they were anti-tank mines and had two big springs in them. And the springs was to stop them exploding by personnel walking over them, but if a tank or vehicle went off, compressed the spring and ignited the bomb. And we used to go out and take the top off and take the springs out and put little anti-personnel Italian mines in and put the thing back again. And of course the Italians used to walk over and blow themselves up.
Was there a great deal of booby trapping of areas like this going on?
Oh yes,
the two sides?
Yes, a lot of it. They used to have one anti-personnel thing. It was a terrible thing. It was like an ordinary 303 bullet, but it had three prongs above, and one prong, that one, and they put them in the ground, and if you stood on them, when you pressed the plunger, they used to fire, and one round used to shoot up the leg. The other one was a jack-in-the-box, which we used to call a plant pot mine. It was shaped like an ordinary 3-inch plant pot, and it had a stem on the top with three wires sticking out. And this was buried in the sand, and just the wires just underneath. Again, when you stood on these, it compressed it and ignited the, activated the thing, and then it should shoot up about 2 foot from the ground and then explode. And it was all ball bearings and this sort of thing. It caused a lot of injuries. Of course, you had the Tiller mine, which is an anti-tank mine. They were German mines, and to alter them or to set them, you used to use a coin, and you turn a screw, about an inch in diameter. You turned it, and you put red to red, made it set to explode, or green to red was safe. So we used to go out and move the earth from them, and get a coin or something and turn it green to red, and then lift them under the supervision of the engineers. And of course, Germans got to know we're doing this, so they altered it and they put red to green live and opposite. And of course, we were actually, what we were doing after that was setting them live, and then when we come to move them, they were blown up. And all this sort of thing went on. There was other things like, the Italians started, first of all, dropping bars of soap around the desert. People were picking it up and using it, and it was like a caustic, took all the skin off the face. There was fountain pens. Of course, most of the old soldiers says, well, what, you won't find a fountain pen lying in the middle of a desert or something like that, but some of the lads picked them up, and again, when they screwed them, they blew up and blew the hand off or the fingers off or something like that. They were full of these sort of tricks. Of course, Germans were worse still later on during the war. When they come to Normandy, they had all kinds of queer things set up. Mm-hmm.
Did the British also use this kind of approach, this booby trapping?
I never heard of, other than mines, of course. We had our own proper mines. Our mines was around like a pan, about a 10 inches in diameter, and it was a cup, on a cup, and ours was two phials of acid, and you put them in and put them under the sun. The way they worked is, if anything went over them, they used to break the phial, and the two phials reacted the acid and blew the mine up. And fortunate about those was, as they'd been lying a long time, the files used to get rusted into the metal, and you couldn't get the things out, and they had to blow them up to move them, to get rid of them. But I never heard of our people using anti-personnel. Well, I'd never heard of them.
Was there any enemy weapon or device which was really feared by the troops more than any other?
Not really in the desert, that part of the war. I mean, we only had the Breeder, the Italian. They used to fire, and every third round was a tracer, a red tracer. And when you're going towards it, you see the red coming towards you, and it maybe hit the ground in front and bounce and go over the top, or it went past you. Of course, you realise there was other two rounds in between every one of those you've seen. Germans, they use a spander, but I wouldn't say we feared. The only fear we ever had, really, but it didn't affect much into Brute, was the 88mm gun, which is a very good gun. I mean, nobody liked that.
Was there any occasions when you had to maintain your positions because of damage or anything of that order?
No, I can't. I can't say it never happened to us. We had mortar bombs. We had three lads killed. One stand to actually a mortar bomb hit the gun emplacement and killed three of them. But they were concrete, you know, and it took a lot of damage. Took a lot of punishment. The other ones, the earth, or the ones that was dug by us into the sand, when I mentioned about the Stukas raiding, now they used to fill a few places in, had to be cleared and redug and dugouts rebuilt, things like that.
During the time that you were there, do you recall any men who received medals for particular acts of bravery or courage?
One chap, Oliver, Corporal Oliver, he got the MM when we raided this, I think it was 167 or 176, this point outside the corridor that we attacked. He wasn't in our company, but he was forward. He got the MM for I don't know what actually done, but he maybe helped to take a position of some kind, but they just heard about it later on.
What are your recollections over the whole of the time that you're in Tobruk? What are your recollections about any particular officers?
Well, our own officer was very good. Lieutenant, I'm forgetting his name now, the Lieutenant Townsend. No, that wasn't it, I'm forgetting him. The company commander was Major Vokes, and Captain, I keep on saying Sanderson, I don't know whether that was the name or not, it was very Captain. Because in Tobruk, you were in your own little positions, and you had very little contact with the company headquarters, which was behind you. That's where I used to go from the front line down to get the password, and I used to see them each night. But other than that, we had very little contact with them in Tobruk. Your own little area, your little dugouts, and that was you. And you were in a sort of world of your own, and you didn't no dealings with anybody else.
Do you have any recollections of any individual characters in action who were particularly noteworthy? Or even actually out of action? There must have been some characters in your battalion that possibly stand out.
Yeah, the characters there. And I think it was one, I think I already mentioned, Sergeant Giles, that would never swear. You used to call him Flipper Giles because instead of swearing, he used to say flipping this and flipping that. And the only time he swore was when he got shot in the behind by a Tommy gun ammunition by some idiot in front.
Mm-hmm. How did you manage to get through these days? Most of the time you must have been out of action, nothing going on very much. How did you get through each day? It must have been pretty boring.
Well, during the day, as I said, you've done very little during the day, but at night time you're always active. As I say, we're always on patrols of some kind. And then you had the extra guard duty at night in front of your wire, the pairs that used to walk up and down, and you had people on standby in the positions, and then you had the listening force out in front, and as I say, you had all these patrols going out. So it was quite active at night, each night. There's always something going on. I mean, at night time, you hear in the distance, you could see tracers flying from different positions where people were in action in one way or another.
Do you recall anyone who suffered from shell shock or anyone who attempted to injure themselves to get out of action or to get out of the line?
I can't say I ever knew or heard of anybody in our company, but it was heard that was quite a lot. When we first went in, we heard about the Australians. The Australians used to put a bullet through their ankle to get brought out. And then they found that there was powder burns and they were charged with self-inflicted wounds. So what they used to do was put a tin of bully beef and they used to fire through the bully beef to try and avoid the doings. The other one was they used to shoot their finger off, thinking, well, if they shoot their finger off, they can't fire. They were always taken back and court-martialed. I never heard of anybody committing suicide, I think, like that. I've heard of one lad who if you remember, I told you about the carriers went out, and me and a chap called Jimmy Harper had to go with the anti-tank rifle and sort of cover the opening for when they came back, in case Jerry come through. And we went into the dugout afterwards when the officer called in and he gave us a half pint of rum each and we got some more when he had to go and answer the phone. Now, there's another lad on the position. He got at the rum, and he had a drink, a good drink of the rum. And in his dugout, he put the blanket over his head, and in the morning, they found him dead with the fumes from the rum.
What were your worst memories of Tobruk?
I think air raids, when we used to get raided by Stukas, and you couldn't do nothing, just had to sit and just take it. I think they were pretty bad, and obviously the ration was very basic. And as you were surrounded always, I mean, Jerry got right away down to Mers and Madru, and you were stuck in Tobruk, miles away from anybody. If it hadn't been for the Navy happening to come in with destroyers and that. That one, the Plonk one, was pretty terrifying. And of course, some of these raids that you went on when you got into the German wire and things like that, it could be pretty active. You come back and you couldn't see any end to it. I mean, we never knew when we were going to be relieved from Tobruk. We didn't know we were going to break out. We were informed of this.
Did you ever feel that you would be stuck there until something happened to you?
Well, I used to say when I was sitting there in the daytime in this front position in the dugout and looking out, and I says, if I ever get home after this, I'll go in a pub and have a pint of beer, and another thing, I'll never complain about food again, and I says I'll never waste food, which I never do now. You know, when I think about what I used to look forward to, and I hear people complaining now, I thought, but you sort of felt as though you're never going to get out of it. You couldn't see any hopes of anything get out. I mean, they were coming up the desert, and then they were pushed back again, and we didn't know how long we were going to be in Tobruk. Like that thing, I mean, it was from February 1935, you know, and young kids coming out from England. I mean, before I never thought about England. Meeting all these young kids again brought it all back again.
Do you have any good memories of Tobruk?
Oh, yes. Friendship as a people, you know. You found true friends there because you had nothing. You just had everybody exactly the same. And there was no selfishness. I never met any of it. The Australian 12th, 13th, I think it was, the battalion we relieved in our position, they went back by destroyer to Alex. We heard afterwards, escorting prisoners down, and majority of them were lost. Submarines sank the convoy, and unfortunately most of them were lost. The other thing is, we had some personnel. One was Sergeant Metcalf, used to be the officer's mess. Used to run the officer's mess in peacetime. He was one of them picked to escort prisoners on a convoy down, and he was killed, and a few more. German submarine sank the convoy, so they were lost through.
Did you have a lot of casualties over the whole time you were there?
No, not bad at all. You just got the odd one daily as it went on, you know, dismounted up. But we hadn't a great lot of casualties. We're very fortunate.
How important do you feel that the regimental spirit was in getting you through all this, keeping you together and getting you through? Was it an important, had it an important part to play?
Well, not so much in Tobruk, for the simple reason, as I say, you were in each individual section positions within a platoon. The company headquarters is away, and then another company was a few hundred yards away from you. You had no personal contact with them. All you could see is now and again the heads up from the positions in the sun. So you didn't mix within the battalion. When I used to go down for the password, down there they had a wireless company headquarters. And I used to go down at the time of the BBC News was on, and I used to get the news and bring it back to the front. And of course, all they said was there was activity on the patrol and activity. It didn't say what regiment or anything. So, of course, as soon as you got away from there and you got mixed up with other regiments, immediately, I mean, they used to say, well, I wonder what the rest of them did during the war other than your regiment. You know, we used to go on. Of course, each regiment was the same. They're very proud of the regiment because they had a very good record.
Did you have any religious beliefs, Mr. Thornthwaite?
Not really. I used to say my prayers there just like any other time, but not really. Of course, it's like all persons, when you're in a tight spot, you're going to do this and that. But not really. During the war, before you went into action, there was always a service for them that wanted to in the field somewhere. But I didn't bother. Because actually, right through the war, I never expected to survive. I mean, each as you went on, year after year, you seen the numbers going all the time. You thought, well, it's obviously your time is going to come eventually. But I look back, very, very fortunate.
Did you feel, and I know this is going ahead, but taking in your experiences in the desert, and then, of course, you went through Normandy, did you feel that your courage was ebbing out a little bit? It was becoming harder to go on?
Yes. I found that the more action you've seen, the more weary you become. Because obviously you're learning what could happen. I think the first action I went in was that raid on Plonk at night with the young Scotsman behind us. Now, to me, that was the first time I'd been in an action, so I wasn't frightened because I didn't know what to expect. Just the noise, and I thought, well, this is it, not done. But when you come to do it again, you know what's going to happen, so you start taking precautions. I used to drink with a friend years ago, and he used to be in the Royal Engineers. And he used to say, that you people that was in the regulars are the world's worst. He says, as soon as there was a bang, he says, you used to go and take cover. Well, I can understand that because they know what was going to happen, whereas the young kids who were just coming out looked round and say, well, what's the matter? And the longer it went, the more you wanted to survive, I suppose.
You said that you had the engineers with you. Were there any other supporting arms close by you in the line that were
not in the front line? We had our own anti-tank rifles. What was it? 6-pounder. We had a 6-pounder there, and that was our only anti-tank rifle gun. We had the artillery behind us, dug in again, 25-pounders. When we broke out, we met the tank corps. But other than that, it's funny, different parts of the front line in Tobruk, when we first went was a salient, was totally different to the, a salient will be the north of Tobruk, and the south of Tobruk, Al Duda down that way, was a totally different, for some reason. You had the tank corps, you had... And down the centre of Tobruk, you had the Royal Army Service Corps, what was left of them, with trucks, and they still had trucks, because you still had to move stuff around in Tobruk. And of course, petrol had to be brought in by destroyers.
You mentioned something about wooden guns, wooden artillery.
Yeah, well, we had wooden agag guns. The idea to kid Jerry that, well defended. Of course, he's only got to go through once, and we didn't fire, and he realised that they were just dummies.
Uh-huh. Can we move on out to where we were last time? That was you'd reached Alexandria.
And yes.
Did you go from there?
Well, we broke out, as I say, and we went down to Alex, and I'm not sure, after Christmas it was sometime, we had this... drinking session and doings. And then I think it was about a month after we told to pack what gear we had, and we're moving out again. Well, I remember when we're down at Alexander, everybody, Churchill, was on the wireless about the marvellous Tobruk garrison that held out against odds and so and so, and had now been relieved, and he's quite proud of them. We had to go down to the docks at Alexander. Edward Gear, and we got on a boat called the Breconshire, was a naval supply boat, and we moved onto that. I think about three companies moved onto this boat. It wasn't very big. It was loaded up with ammunition, bombs and everything, and all this. It was all naval personnel running it. And then we sailed out of Alex. We didn't know where we were going, so we'd going about a day and a half, and then they came over the Tannite on the boat. They said that you're going to Malta. And we thought, well, thanks very much, Mr. Churchill. You've done a garrison duty at Tobruk, and you're coming out and you're going into Malta now, a garrison island. But it was quite pleasant on this boat. There was very little room. One plane came over. We were telling the Navy blokes, oh, one plane is nothing, because we'd seen it in Tobruk. We'd thought they'd just come from England and knew nothing, you know, what used to call bumming your load. The sailor says, well, he says, yes, but he says, that's just a spotter. He says, it's not coming within range of the guns, it's just circling around. He says, it'll go back, and he says, and then we'll get the raid started. Well, for some reason, the Breconshire, they say the naval supply boat, taking us to Malta, it had an escort of over 35 naval destroyers, cruisers, and everything. We couldn't understand it, why there was such a big escort for one boat, the Breconshire, right in the middle, and surrounded by all these naval boats. But what actually happened was half of it left and went and met the Italian Navy, and there was a battle in the Mediterranean, left it. But anyway, as the Navy, the sailor, the matlow, said that there'll be a raid come over within a few hours, and no sooner had he said that than the blooming sky was black with 88s, Stukas, 87s and whatnots came over. And they started bombing. And they didn't bomb the Navy boats, the destroyers. They're all bombing us and right in the middle. Because they obviously knew that was most important for all this escort. We were down below decks on this thing because it wasn't made for carrying troops. It was made for carrying cargo, ammunition, oil, and petrol and stuff like that. So we were stuck anywhere down below out the road, and they kept us out the road. Well, our CO went and seen the captain, and he said that we have all these Bren guns. We have about 80 Bren guns here, the regiment. He says, and we have the tripods to put them on for ACAC. He says, why can't we put them up on the deck and help your people when these raids come over? So the captain was reluctant, but he agreed. So we put these tripods up with a Bren gun on all around the boat. Now, all naval small arm guns, where they're on, they have a guardrail around it so that the gun can only go certain areas, because if they're firing at planes, they don't want to start shooting this up, so the guard stops them from hitting. Of course, all our Bren guns had no guards on them. And the raid started, and our people were going mad firing. The captain was flat on his blooming face on the bridge because the blokes was falling, and the bullets from the Bren was going through the bridge and around. And when the raid finished, the captain come out and he went mad. He says, get that lot down below. He says, a greater hazard than what the enemy is. Get them below. He says, out the road. So they put us down below. And during one raid, the bombing was very near, and the tanks, oil tanks, fractured. Well, I was in the forepeat with another company, and these oil tanks fractured, and the oil was about 6 inches deep. And we're all equipment, and we're plodging in oil, and what a mess it was. And then they had paravanes out. Now, a paravane, they put a hawser, steel hawser, out about 200 or 300 yards, and at the end there's a thing like a torpedo, but it goes through the water, and it keeps this wire taut, and it's against mines. Any mines, it cuts the mines up. Of course, where we were, where it was connected in the forepeak, it was like being inside of a drum, the noise. It was terrible. So we pleaded with the Navy people to take the things out. They said we'd rather be blooming mind us have that thing going all the time, but they wouldn't. They kept them up. We eventually got to Malta. I forget now. It was about a 4 or 5 days run, I think. Got to Malta. The raid seemed to be continuous all the way there, and when we got into Grand Harbour, the raid was still on and was still being bombed, and they had these old buses in Malta, and they took us straight off the Breconshire, and we went straight into these buses, and they took us up to the Rabat area of the island where we were going to be stationed.